friends. Thank you so much for joining us again for another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rotter, and I'm joined here by...
It me, Alice Slater.
This week we are going to chat to you about three books we have recently read that fall under the umbrella of what we're going to call Girls Interrupted. Should we kick it off with the title that came up most recently, Alice?
Yes.
So tell us about our first book.
So our first book, which I would also say was like the inspo for this episode, is a book called Problems by Jade Sharma, which came out in May of this year from Tramp Press, which is a small Irish publisher.
Indeed it is.
And it is, it's fiction, but I think it certainly falls under that like veiled autobiography.
Yeah.
So I hear. About a young woman living in New York with functional... addiction to opiates.
Indeed. It's about Maya, who's struggling to kind of live in the world and live in her marriage and do things with his family and go celebrate Thanksgiving and just participate in a world that is not kind of heroin.
Yeah, she needs like a kind of heroin bubble to deal with
literally anything.
Everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you like this book?
I did. I really like this book. It felt a lot like the kind of books that men write a lot, but I don't read a lot from women. Just kind of not particularly likeable narrators, doing very destructive and self-destructive things. It felt kind of good and interesting to read that from like a woman's point of view.
And because it's quite gross. Like, it's very kind of, there's a lot of bodily functions in it.
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of writing is normally reserved for men. So I quite enjoy reading a woman being disgusting.
Mm.
I like it. Why not?
I agree. I found it zipped along very well. Like, it's very well paced. Yeah, I found it was a pretty solid reading experience.
Also, I feel like I've read a lot of books with heroin at their heart, but never one that doesn't end up with the character injecting.
Yeah,
like,
we were talking about this.
Yeah, we talked about this the other day. It kind of shows this very different, more like socially acceptable side to addiction.
Yeah, like weirdly functional way of being addicted to heroin. I don't think I've ever read an account of someone being very seriously addicted to heroin where you never read about them injecting once.
Yeah.
Because I'm also reading the Patrick Melrose books by Edward St. Aubyn, and that is, like, extremely graphic, injection-heavy. Like, it is one of... I've never read anything like it, just in terms of how frequent, how graphic, how gnarly the accounts of injecting heroin art in that book, whereas you get to the end of Problems and you're like, that was a completely different thing. That was like a completely different, like, they're two accounts of very intense experiences of the same drug, and yet they make it completely different by virtue of like consuming it differently, which I find really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's certainly like a refreshing angle on it all. And also, obviously, even though it's not like Rec Room for a Dream level injecting into your infected arm, like, grim, it is obviously still like very unappealing.
It didn't make me want to do, like, just because there wasn't any injecting and the gnarly side of injecting, it did not make me want to do heroin. Did you want to do heroin?
I personally know that I will never need to do heroin because I have come on Eileen.
Yes.
In my life.
Yes. If you are not familiar with one of the great tweets of all time, is by our friend Charlie Sardines, about how he doesn't need to try heroin because the bit where Come On Eileen slows down and then speeds up again must be what coming up feels like.
Yeah.
So anyone that's read that tweet also doesn't need to try heroin.
Yeah, I'm addicted to Come On Eileen. That's my
drug of choice. So something I found really interesting with this book was that it took a very amoral stance on sex work, which was something I had not encountered in many books, let alone, I don't know, books by women, weirdly. You know, I just feel like if you're a woman writing about sex work, it is often from this very, like, faux feminist-y point of view. So to read a book where someone does sex work in order to buy drugs, and they just, you know, describe it as if it was any other job. And there's a really good paragraph where she says something about, wouldn't it be so great if I could just go to a job interview? And when they said, what was your previous job? I would say, I was doing sex work to feed my drug habit and I don't want to do it anymore. That's why I'm here. And yeah, I found that very compelling and interesting.
I think because it also, it shows like a type and a way into sex work that, again, I don't think I'm like, I've only really kind of have any understanding of it because of Twitter.
Yeah, because you know, like, real sex work as we know, rather than like a character in a book.
Exactly. And like she uses Craigslist, was it? Or like OkCupid? I can't remember. Craigslist. She's like, she used Craigslist to meet guys that then like pay her for various services. Like, it's a completely different
Unsensational. Like, it is literally just this, I needed some money, I knew that this was where I could get money quickly.
So much so that at first I think, like, in fact, every time she goes on, she goes to, like, meet someone, I'm never quite sure whether it's actually a date or if it's a job. Because she does also, like, later on, doesn't she date
Craigslist as well? Yeah, she meets people for, like, non-paying encounters. So, yeah, that I found really interesting and pleasant. There's something that we found not so pleasant in this book.
The elephant in the room.
Pardon the pun.
So I did a thread on Twitter about fat phobia in fiction relatively recently, and it was inspired by this book.
And we have talked about it extensively off the record since then, and we've drawn some conclusions that we feel are worth saying, rather than just like, do not read this book, because we do recommend this book.
Yeah.
If you are very sensitive to, you know, kind of fat phobia in literature, this is probably not the, you know, if you're like extremely hypersensitive, probably not the one for you. But yeah, we've talked about it a lot, and what would we conclude?
So the character isn't nice, and the character also has an eating disorder. And that's why I feel like this book is a little bit different, because the way in which she views the world is through this really fucked up lens.
Yeah.
And part of it is that she restricts what she eats, and her goal is to be as thin as possible, which I think surprised me, because on the back of the book, like, I read the blurb and there's a list of her problems. Her problems are like her drug addiction, her boyfriend, like her relationships in trouble, her job's on the line, like everything's,
her mom's dying,
her mother's sick, like everything's going wrong for her. But that element of her like list of problems isn't actually mentioned, so it took me quite a long time to realize that this isn't just shorthand for her being a not very nice person. This is actually an intrinsic part of how she sees the world. It doesn't mean I felt that it was always strictly necessary. Like, it did get quite tiring, especially there's one moment where she and her friend are like gloating over a high school crush that's got fat, and they're kind of cracking jokes about like, maybe he must eat like donuts for breakfast, and it's kind of played for humor in a way that I really don't fucking like.
Yeah,
but
I agree,
when it's when it's this kind of narrative that's just a bit more complicated than just the character isn't nice, so this is her being unkind, like, I can be a little bit more flexible. I can forgive it.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't blame someone for being put off by it.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, there are pages where back to back for 3 or 4 pages, there is something on every page that makes you pull the grimacing emoji face. It just has so, it's such a shame because it has so much to offer. It has so many interesting things to offer. But I think we would not feel good about, like, talking about this without knowing how many listeners are, like, fat girls.
Mm-hmm.
I think it wouldn't be right to, like, have this chat about a book that we both really enjoyed and got a lot out of and thought was very inventive and original and interesting, but we didn't talk about that element of it.
But also, like, when we did our Fat and Fiction episode, we focused more on books that do it right.
Yeah.
And, like, we've never really had a conversation about books that get it wrong.
Yeah, and I feel like this got it much less wrong, or at least it contextualized the fatphobic elements much better than another book I was reading recently and just had to stop reading, which came out very recently. It's called Social Creature by Tara Isabella Burton, and it's had a lot of hype on my timeline. It's a book I'm interested in because, you know, it's kind of sold as being a bit like Talented Mr. Ripley, a bit like Gossip Girl, you know.
Yeah,
shit,
yeah.
The shit that we like.
Spicy.
Spicy. And I just had to stop reading it because I found the fatphobia in it so depressing and so alienating. And I just think it's such a shame knowing that, like, I love reading books, you love reading books. We are, like, thirsty for books. We read so many books. And we will put a book aside if it feels like someone was trying to make us feel bad. And I don't know, just, it seems like such a waste. I can't think of any books that were really enhanced by an unnecessary streak of fatphobia. So with Social Creature, one of my problems was that the main character who displays all of this repeated fatphobia, like, weighs herself, and her weight is put in the book explicitly.
That is such a no-no.
Yeah, and I will not repeat what that number is, but it is a very low number. So you know that this is coming from someone who ain't fat. That this is coming from someone... Like, I just felt like it was really irresponsible of the author to put in an explicit weight. And that I absolutely cannot get my head around it.
I'm really surprised that no one in the editing process said, "Do we need this? Do we need to put in the exact number?"
Yeah, it's wild. Mm-hmm. It felt completely unnecessary and nefarious. I wanted to keep reading Problems. I didn't want to keep reading Social Creature.
And I think, like, I would be really interested to hear what other people think about the use of fatphobia as it's used to make her eating disorder socially acceptable because other people agree with her. Like, she isn't alone. The fatphobia isn't all in her head. It's also in conversations she has with other people. So I do feel like actually this is the world in which the character exists in.
In Problems,
yeah. I'm talking about now, yeah. At first I hated it for that, but the book was so compelling.
Yeah, and it was a well-constructed world of often not particularly likable people.
Mm-hmm.
The more of Problems I read, the less, pardon the pun, problems I had with that part of it. I didn't like reading it, but it didn't make me think, like, this book is not for me.
Mm-hmm. Mostly, because mostly it's very throwaway. It's very throwaway comments, which is why fatphobia in itself is so insidious, because it's perpetual and it's just these tiny microaggressions.
Banal bullshit, yeah.
But yeah, like, the rest of the world is so well constructed. Like, I absolutely loved the whole bit where she goes for Thanksgiving with her boyfriend's, like, disgustingly wholesome family. And, like, I just really dug the character voice throughout.
Yeah.
This whole bit where she's, like, in this, like, wholesome Christian American home.
Wholesome, yet very joyless. Like, weirdly, just, yeah. And I there's a bit where she advises them to watch a film, and that turns out to be a bad film. Like, a socially bad choice for no reason. Like, when you're reading it, you're, like, you're on her side. And that's what I really like, is that, like, I don't know, she was such a believable character. Like, she isn't a bad... She isn't, like, 100% bad, just because I don't personally like her or want to know her as a friend. Like, when you're reading the book, you are often on her side. The world is weird sometimes, and
also, like, I mean, I do wonder, I'm talking about her being an unlikable narrator, but I do wonder if she's intentionally unlikable.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously, addiction makes people selfish, and... She's very selfish.
Oh, yeah, like, I was completely assuming that she was written that way. That it wasn't just, I personally don't want her to, like, be my friend. Like,
she's meant to be quite a kind of...
spiky, prickly...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because she makes some, like, bad choices and...
What I really enjoyed was the dynamic between her and this dude that she's having an affair with. This, like, old dude who just has no interest in her. And she does her... biggest, like, wildest, like, obsessive behavior
of
him.
Of course you love the wild, obsessive,
bad behavior. Yeah. It's so much what I enjoy reading about. I just love reading about women behaving completely unreasonably to men they are interested in. It is literally one of my favorite things to read about. So I really like that. There's just so much in this book that I liked that I feel like I don't want our feelings about the fat phobia to completely overshadow all of the good things that we enjoyed. But exactly. As I said, I feel like it's something that we needed to, like, get off our chubby chests.
But that's why I mentioned my Twitter thread, because in my Twitter thread I didn't say what the book was, because it's not fair for this book to be a poster child for, like, every single book that has fat phobia in it. And it is, although it comes up a lot, it's a small part of it. Ultimately, the book, I mean, her eating disorder isn't a small part of it. Her eating disorder is a very big part of it. But that element of it is just a small part of her psyche in the way that she exists in a world in which fat isn't acceptable. And she's made the decision that she doesn't want... That's not really fair to say she's made the decision, but she has...
Taken on the burden.
Yeah, that societal pressure has had this massive effect on her. Her psyche. Anyway, the reason why it's included in this list is because, obviously, at the end of the book, the latter third of the book, she spends in a rehab centre. And that element of it, although it's... the rehab element really reminded me of a book that we're not actually going to go into particularly, but this is a good juncture to mention it. Clean by Juno Dawson.
Which Alice has read, but I have not.
Yes, so we're not going to go into, like, great detail. But Clean is also a book that... the main character is basically Paris Hilton. Like, she's an heiress to a hotel chain. She's an absolute millionaire. And a heroin addict at 17. And those scenes where the main character in Clean, which, forgive me, I can't remember her name, really reminded me of Problems by Jay Chalmers. They had like a little...
crossover vibe.
Yeah, a little vibe in common.
But interestingly, with Problems, the rehab section is the stuff that I've retained the least. Like, I found... with the other two books we're going to talk about, well, one of them, that is all the book is. Another, it's, like, an important element of the book. With Problems, I find that it's her trying to interact with the real world, like, the world outside of any kind of protection or help, that I found the most interesting. And
yes, same.
Yeah.
Clean is actually YA.
Cool.
Which surprises me, to be honest.
It's got some strong content.
It has a very strong content, but it's kind of like... for me, it was quite aspirational, which I found really odd for a young adult book about heroin.
Interesting.
I don't know. Let me know what you think.
Yeah, well, I'll read it.
Oh, I meant you,
The royal you. Let the royal us know what the royal you thinks. So...
I did the surf's up symbol. Okay, so let's... Should we trot on to book two?
Yes, I think so. Adventure? So, book two... is The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. Alice, tell me about your history of reading The Bell Jar.
That is such a great question. I read The Bell Jar when I was about 19, 20, I think. I always thought I was 16, but I was actually thinking about it the other day, and I was definitely older than that. I wasn't a teenager. So I read it then, and then I read it again about 3 years ago, and it is like I'd never read it before. I remembered almost nothing, so it was like reading it for the first time again. And then I read it about... a week ago, and again, it was like reading it for the first time, because I fucking cannot remember a thing in that book. It just doesn't stick with me at all.
I will move on, after I have given you my account of reading The Bell Jar, to why I believe that could be the case. Ooh,
okay. I just thought it was stupid.
Maybe you are, but maybe you're not. So I read this book when I was about 16. I remember I was reading it on my way to school. I remember reading it on the tram, which I took to school every day. I did not reread it for a very long time because of one scene in it, which I found so disturbing that in my mind, it lasted about 20 pages. When I reread it, like, it stayed with me. Like, I remember where I was on the tram. I was at Lebanon Road tram stop when I was reading this, It disturbed me so much. I remember words in the description that I found so distressing and disgusting and stressful that I never voluntarily reread it. It's a very, very minor scene, very near the beginning, where she sees a woman having a cesarean.
What?
Yeah. I remember everything about that, except for the fact that it literally lasts a paragraph. I don't know why. I was a very, very sensitive young person.
And you're a very visual person.
I'm a very visual person. Yeah. I find any account of, like, violence or injury very, like... I'm better now, but when I was younger, I literally couldn't watch anything that had any kind of incision making, any bones breaking, like, anything. I was just very, like... I just wanted to die. So that's why it took me so long to reread The Bell Jar, was because of this very minor thing that, yeah, it really is not even important in the book. You probably don't even remember what I'm talking about unless you've read it a lot. So I reread it a couple of weeks ago, and yeah, it was not the same book at all. Like, I don't remember anything. And I think maybe, so my theory about why neither of us retained stuff about The Bell Jar between readings is that I think it has this, like, mythology about its content and how, like, sad and dark and deep it is, deep and meaningful. And I actually find, like, a lot of it isn't compatible with that memory. Like, the first stuff, like, the first bits with her, like, gadding about New York on this weird competition she's won with this ladies' magazine, like, that, to me, like... Obviously, she always has this, like, underlying mental illness, but though that kind of world and her, like, going out and having fun and going to parties and hanging out with her gal pals, it doesn't... That's not what you would remember about a book that's famously about, like, institutional mental illness and... I don't know. I think that's partly why we forget what it's about.
I mean, I think... The New York bits are always the bits that I forget. You're totally right. Like, even though I think they tend to be more visual.
Yeah.
But that kind of reminds me of when the 50th anniversary edition came out and the cover had a woman with a compact on it. And loads of people, like, freaking out about the fact that that is not appropriate for The Bell Jar.
It kind of is.
It's 100% is. They get given compacts. Yeah. Like, the items literally feature in the book. But I remember talking to our friend... Maeve, the Plath
Diaries. Yes, I thought of Maeve a lot while I was reading this book.
I remember when I was rereading it, was around the time that the 50th anniversary cover came out. And Maeve said to me that she was, like, she thought the cover was great because it's showing a different side of the book.
Yeah, that... which is totally there.
Yeah.
It's not like you have to dig deep hidden. To find it. Like, and I think maybe that's because we think that fun lady things are not compatible with, you know... people getting electric shock treatment, whereas some people, they are part of the same life. They could happen in the same year. Like, they are all part of the same experience of being a young woman. So yeah, I think that's a real, really interesting element of that whole conversation that I feel was kind of overlooked. Like, I think on a knee-jerk reaction, you would be like, that's not what The Bell Jar's about. The Bell Jar is a deep and serious book. And, like, obviously it is, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a whole section where she describes people's outfits and her outfits in great detail, that they're not doing all of these, you know, women's magazine things. And
I feel like if you're going to argue that putting a woman checking her lipstick on the cover of The Bell Jar is intrinsically misunderstanding what The Bell Jar is about, then I think you're intentionally trying to avoid linking The Bell Jar to the world
femininity.
Of fashion, femininity, makeup, beauty. And you can't separate those two things.
Yeah.
You can't take them out of the book because the book
is about both of the books.
It's snobbery, isn't it? It's trying to avoid anything that could potentially look like women's fiction.
Yeah, what's wrong with a book about women written by a woman?
Everything!
Yeah, so I'm really glad I reread it, because it is not what I remembered at all, because my remembrance of it has been so coloured by the kind of cultural understanding of what The Bell Jar is and Sylvia Plath's life. And I found so much of it quite funny. Like, I think her writing is really funny.
She's so funny. The character's voice is amazing.
Just these kind of little old-fashioned... asides and, like, little comments and disparaging remarks about people, or, like, just her assessment of the world, I just found very funny.
So one of my unexpected favourite scenes in The Bell Jar is when Esther and Doreen go back to that dude's flat.
Near the beginning.
Right at the beginning. So they're supposed to go to, like, some ritzy dinner, and a ball, but then their cab, they're caught in like a gridlock, sweltering hot. And these guys come over to the cab and just invite them to come for a drink instead. And it's just this amazing New York moment of like...
spontaneity.
They're soaked in sweat and they like jump out the cab and go and have a drink with these dudes. And they end up back at his house. And Doreen says to her, like, don't leave me alone with this one.
Mm.
And she actually says something like, I wouldn't be able to put up much of a fight. Which I thought at first, I was like, oh, God, that's such strange like language. But I feel like... it's in that kind of, in the 1960s, you're kind of expected to put up a fight. What she really means is, like, I'm not going to be able to resist him.
I don't want to.
Yeah. I don't want to resist him, so you have to stick around. So, anyway, Esther's drinking her, like, whiskey or whatever and getting quite drunk. And she hears Doreen kind of scream and she turns around, like, horrified. And there's just the most amazing image of... the dude has this woman over his shoulder. She's biting his earlobe. And at first, Esther's like, fuck, what's going on? And then she realizes that her boobs have fallen out of her dress. And they're actually, like, just in the throes of passion. And it's such an amazing image. And she kind of just slips out and leaves them to bang.
I remember that. Just love it. Yeah, and it's peppered with moments like that.
Like, very picturesque.
Yeah. But obviously, there is, you know, especially in the second half of the book, when she goes... first to one institution and then to another. The first where she is given electric shock treatment and not a lot else, and it isn't a particularly kind of happy or productive experience. And then on to the other where she seems to make more progress with... something that I'm still not particularly clear on is what she is experiencing. How would we categorise her illness... now?
So, I mean, I just assumed that she had depression. I don't think, from my reading of it, I don't think that she seemed to have,
a personality disorder.
Yeah, a personality disorder. Or even, like, she doesn't have manic periods or anything. Like,
okay, cool. I just thought...
I think it was just, like, chronic depression.
Yeah.
Which I guess, like, because... quote unquote, there's like nothing wrong with her.
Yeah.
They didn't know how to deal with that kind of ailment, I guess.
So they gave her.
So they thought, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll just
run some volts through her.
Some fucking horrendous. I mean, it is horrendous. It's completely horrendous that this was happening within our parents' lifetime.
Yeah, but then even more horrendous is like she literally casually befriends a girl who's literally had a lobotomy.
That's so wild.
Like that is so, like to me that is literally the wildest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, that is completely wild, isn't it? But then, like, when was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest written?
Yeah, probably around then.
Have you read that?
No, is it good?
Mate, it is such a banger. It's so good.
If we weren't doing The Ladies, we could have, you know, that would be a good one for us to read.
That would have been a great one to include in this episode. I just didn't think of it.
Yeah, we couldn't have called it Girls Interrupted then, could we?
Yeah, that's true. We'd have to change the title.
People, comma, Interrupted. So yeah, I feel like I really got a lot out of reading The Bell Jar for another time.
Me too. And I feel like it's one of those books that maybe I will just every 3 to 5 years... I'll just come back to. I'll let myself forget it again, and then... it's strange. I mean, I don't really know why it doesn't stick in my head as much. Maybe this time it's finally going to really cement in there.
Yeah, now that we've, like, conversed about the elements of it that are often overlooked.
But I feel like this is the third time I've read it. I've read The Secret History 3 times, spread over about the same time period, and I feel that that book is completely...
implanted in your brain.
Yeah, like... but not just specific scenes and images and the plot, but, like, lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
Like, the bones of the language.
Make you think. We want to know about your experience of reading The Bell Jar.
I told my experience of reading The Bell Jar.
I'm talking to the royal you.
Oh. Then don't look me in the eye.
Why would I want to look anywhere else? I'm interested in this. Have you had a similar experience to me and Alice, or when you read it, you were like, I understand everything about this book. I have an all-seeing eye. And also Maeve, who is on Twitter as The Plath Diaries, and I think she listens to this. I'm pretty sure she listens to our little pod. I'm
delighted if she did.
We know she did, at least in the beginning, because she emailed us, remember?
Oh, yeah. Aww.
if you have anything you'd like to add to this conversation, Alice and I would deeply like to hear from you. Because Maeve has completed a PhD in Sylvia Plath. So that is someone who I'd like to chat to about this.
Yeah, add us in, mate.
Yeah.
Add us into your PhD.
Yeah, just highlight the relevant parts and we will gladly consume. How about our third book?
Number three is Girl Interrupted
by Susanna Kaysen.
I'm so glad you had that name.
Of course I did.
It's gone. It's gone.
I'm good for the names. I'm good for characters. I'm good for authors. I'm good for little else. So this is an explicitly autobiographical book, which is something I didn't know.
Didn't you?
I didn't know because I haven't seen the film.
I haven't seen the film either.
Interesting. Uh-huh. Well, if it's ever on, we should go. Because I really enjoyed this book. I thought it was great.
Same.
So it's about her experience of going to the doctor for a fairly routine appointment, but she sees a doctor she's never seen before, and within about 20 minutes, she gets shipped off to an asylum.
Fuck, it's so scary.
It's so weird.
It's so scary.
That is what happened. Like, it didn't really occur to me while I was reading it, and then the further you get into the book, it kind of returns to that event, and you're like, yeah, that literally is what happened. And she, unlike in the Bell Jar, she is in one place, and she stays there.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
For, like, 2 years? 18 months?
Yeah, it's 2 years, I think. Mm. And it is, interestingly, the place that Sylvia Plath had stayed in her real life.
Yeah, so it was.
So it was. And yeah, it's completely autobiographical, but something I thought was so interesting about this book is that it was written about 30 years after the things in the book had happened.
Which surprised me, because I assumed that it was written, that it all happened around the same time. I thought it was in the 90s, so I was thinking, like, oh, cool, we have, like, 60s, 90s... contemporary, and then I realised no.
It's someone writing from the 90s about something happening.
Yeah, in the 60s.
I think it's 60s, 60s, 70s.
Late 60s.
Yeah. And I find that really interesting because obviously now there's, you know, especially with like the internet and like essay writing and that kind of thing, there kind of is a compulsion to turn your interesting or traumatic experiences into content for money almost as soon as they've happened, or even in some cases while they're happening. So to read an account of this particularly striking and unusual part of someone's life written with at least 20, 30 years of hindsight, I found really interesting, and it's not what I was expecting because I thought it would be much more recently written.
But my question to you is, do you know for a fact that it was written when it was published?
Because yes, she makes reference.
Oh, does she?
Yeah, there's something, because I thought this. I was like, maybe she wrote it nearer the time.
Because she was a writer. Like, she always wanted to be a writer, and she was always kind of writing.
There's something that she says in the book towards the end that makes it clear that she is writing from, at least that part of the book was written with that kind of distance. Because I thought the same, and then when I read that, I was like, no, in fact, no, she wrote it much later. Because I guess, you know, when you've been in this ward with, like, so many other women, or I guess it doesn't occur to you necessarily that that is a thing that you could turn into work.
Mm.
When it's a thing that didn't just happen to you, it must have happened to hundreds, if not thousands, of people within those walls alone for the period you were there. So, I like that. I liked reading something that had been sat on for some time.
You know what, as well? The most annoying thing, but, you know, that's life. The absolute best part of the book for me, the moment that I just, my entire, like, emotional response was formed, was the very last fucking page. Like, that last paragraph is so emotional, so beautiful, and just so succinctly written. I took a photo of it, and then I thought, I can't fucking post the last page of a book on Instagram. What will people think?
Yeah, this, like, is like when, do you remember my terrible ex-boyfriend Dennis?
Yes.
He showed me a scene from the film Ghost in the Shell, and then I discovered it was the last scene. So now I will literally never watch Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah.
Not that I was like burning to anyway, but I just feel like you are bad. Like,
but you need the build-up. It would be like showing someone, it's like just showing someone the last scene of Beau Travail which is an amazing scene and it works in isolation, but why take away the impact of that scene?
The joy you experience experiencing that scene.
Fucking movie.
Watch Beau Travail. It has literally nothing to do with this, but it is my number one favourite film of all time.
Is it your number one of all time? It is my number one,
yeah.
Oh, so good.
And it's by Claire Denis, who is a lady filmmaker. So, good for her. But yeah, with Girl Interrupted, I found it so, on a very boring level, interesting as an account of what day-to-day life is like when you are in the same place for nearly 2 years. You're not allowed to do anything on your own. You know, she breaks down all of the different, like, levels of privilege that people are allowed, you know, whether that means you are never allowed to be... I think you're never really allowed to go anywhere on your own, but it's whether you're allowed to go with a group of other patients, or you have to have one nurse, or you have to have two nurses, like, if that's how severe they deem your needs to be, you have to have two nurses, blah, blah, blah. Like, I just thought that I found really interesting, like, the day-to-day mechanics of how it works and her experience. I really, really liked that. And I thought she was a great writer.
Yeah. She really, really brings it to life. Every other person, every description of the other kind of... like, the cast of characters that built up the world that she kind of was inhabiting. They're all so well-written. Like, she manages to characterise them within a few pages because the chapters are very short.
It's not a long book and the chapters are not long
either. It's a super speedy read. And also there's a lot of her, like, documents from her medical records are in there as well.
So yeah, so it's almost like instead of explicitly naming dates or periods in her experience of this stay, they're punctuated with, like, medical assessments. And that obviously takes up a whole page, but they're literally photocopies of... the originals.
And I did not read any of them. They were such tiny, they're so badly printed. I was like, what's the point?
Yeah, it was more interesting to see them. I couldn't really glean a lot from them, and especially given how honest I felt she was with her account of what she was going through. I didn't feel like I was going to learn something from those. I really liked there's just a not particularly long stretch where there's already her kind of best friend in the hospital is a girl called Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
And then a new Lisa joins. And because there's already a Lisa, like, the new Lisa is not allowed to thrive. Like, they're very, like, she really wants to be like, she wants to be more like the real Lisa, like the original Lisa.
OG Lisa.
The OG Lisa. Yeah. And she is just not allowed to. And I like that kind of, I just like the way that, like, they were still petty and pointless and, that experiencing, you know, again, electric shock therapy and all of, you know, what was it like being wrapped up in wet blankets or like cold blankets? They list all of the potential treatments for someone. I'm not sure if it's people who have bipolar or schizophrenia, which the author does, or if it's just general treatments that one could experience at this facility. But that even if you're going through all of this stuff, like, it is still when you're like 17, 18, it's like being at school, and like it reproduces the dynamic of school, and then the nurses take the place of teachers, and I liked that. It was like a weird, like, vein of normality through it.
Yeah. I just realised the thing I wanted to say I can't say because it's a spoiler, but it's just wild how the way in which she ends up leaving the institution took my fucking breath away, that's all it took.
Yeah.
Like, it's completely outrageous that she went through so much and such an arbitrary thing.
Decided that she was, yeah. I would recommend people read this.
It's one of those books, like, you read, take it on holiday, you read it in a day.
Yeah. It's really quick.
In fact, I recommend that people read every book that we have discussed, like, in this agree. Little... It was quite intense reading all three at once.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know about you, but I read them pretty much back to back.
Yeah, me too.
That was quite an intense experience. I feel like I have learned a lot of distressing things about mental health care from the 1960s in the UK to present day America.
Yeah. It's true.
Mm-hmm. Although having said that, like, they're certainly not as harrowing as some of the kind of, well, harrowing is the wrong word, but because they're kind of so steeped in reality, that's what makes them shocking. Like, It's not like, I don't know, watching fucking American Horror Story with, like, even though a lot of the elements of the mental health institution in...
American Horror Story Asylum.
Yeah, an asylum. They're based on a real institution, like, real footage. It's obviously, it's played up for horror and...
Yeah, rather than fucking, the grim reality of human lives and the pointless waste of so many years. And...
Exactly.
But yeah, have you got anything else you'd like to add?
No.
Me either. Cool.
I guess, because that's the thing, there's not much to say. It's we read these three books. They're all interesting and different in their own way. Please go and read them and tell us what you think of them.
Yeah, please do. So join us again next time. What will be next time, Alice? Will next time be book club?
Next time will be book club.
Book club will be When I Hit You by Mina Kandasamy. Read it. Join us. It'll be on the first Monday of July. Check your diaries for whenever that is. I'm not going to look in mine. So yeah, if you want to join us for book club, please, read When I Hit You. Did not win the women's prize.
Did not win the women's prize.
Who cares?
Came close.
Yeah, came damn close. And I'm really looking forward to reading it. I haven't read it. Have you read it?
Mm-mm, not
Neither
yet.
Of us have read it, but it's a book that I have been meaning to read, and this is the perfect excuse. So, fingers crossed, we'll enjoy it, and you'll enjoy it as much as we do.
Cool.
Peace out. See you on the flip side.